Welcome to this DFL Education Foundation podcast, featuring a conversation with Eric Nathanson, author of Minneapolis in the 20th Century, The Growth of an American City.
It's a real pleasure for me to be here at the front of the room after being in the audience for so many great DFL Education Foundation downtown discussion groups. And I see folks here who have been making the DFL over the years. I'm going to focus on one chapter of my book today, dealing with downtown development, but there are seven other chapters in the book, and as your college history professor used to tell you, even though you sat through the lecture, you still have to read the book, so there. I'm particularly happy to talk about downtown development right up here on the 40th floor of this building, because we can literally look out the window from where we are right now and to see the results of over 60 years of development activity down here. So I'm going to start by making some general observations about downtown development and then talk about some historic specifics and just a little bit on the ground rules. Normally I like a very informal give and take and questions and comments, but Don has given me a strict 30-minute limit, so I guess I will ask to you can hold off comments and questions, and we should have plenty of time at the end. I tend to talk fast, too fast, but we'll have time for discussion at the end. I want to start out by laying out my basic premise, and that is that I feel that downtown development, particularly that development fostered by public actions, has made a positive contribution to our civic life and has helped create the strong urban center that we have today. But I realize that not everybody agrees with that premise, that in fact, development, and some of you here have been involved in those efforts, has been highly controversial over the last 60 years. Historic preservationists have lamented the loss of key architectural landmarks. Social reformers have criticized the displacement of low-income people, the lack of affordable housing. Activists have lambasted what they see as insider deals and what they call handouts to fat cat developers. And I'll have to admit that, in all honesty, there are certainly elements of truth in all of those charges. But I think if you do look at development over the long term, I think that it has made an amazingly important contribution to this entire region. It really has created downtown as the economic anchor of this region, and more specifically, downtown continues to generate a substantial property tax revenue stream that pays the bills for municipal government, even during these hard-pressed times. But this downtown development didn't just happen on its own. I think it's the result of some very important public-private partnerships that have evolved over the years. And I know public-private partnership is a term that we tend to use a lot, but I think it really was the driving force here in downtown. And I think that partnership had several key elements to it. One, some effective political leadership emanating from City Hall. Two, some enlightened self-interest on the part of the business leadership. And third and finally, some very effective and highly professional city planning. And I think this final factor, city planning, is an issue that doesn't get the attention that it deserves. We tend to think of city planning as this ivory tower occupation, people churning out these reports that nobody reads. But I think in the case of downtown, the planners really did put together some very important blueprints that really did help guide development over the long term, and in just a few minutes we'll talk about one of those, and if I can actually get this to work, we actually may see it on the screen here. Through the last half of the 20th century and certainly into the current century, downtown has ridden the ups and downs of the real estate markets. But I think what's significant is here we've made good use of the ups, and that has sustained us during the down, and certainly we're in another down period right now. And I think, quite frankly, if we had to start the downtown rebuilding process today in the current environment, we would face some almost insurmountable challenges. One, I think quite frankly, the political will would be lacking. Those of you that have been involved in the political world will know what I mean about that. I think our political system is much more fragmented now. The development tools are much weaker than they've been in the past. And third, the financial resources, both in the public and private sector, just aren't there. So I think it's lucky that a lot of this happened in the last century, because it would be very difficult to make that happen in the current century. Getting ahead of the story a little bit, but there is a new vehicle, quite literally, which is helping to propel downtown development, and that is transit. We, of course, have the Hiawatha Light Rail line in place next week. The North Star commuter line is going to be opening, and if Peter Bell and Kathy O'Brien can overcome their differences about Central Corridor, we read about that in the paper today, we're going to have a Central Corridor on the horizon in not too long. And I think all those transit developments are generating business, bringing people downtown with their pocketbooks, and that certainly is all good for downtown. You'll notice that I didn't mention one key new development that I think we can see out the window here, right out there, and that is the ballpark. And as my friends know, I'm not a great fan of the ballpark, but we won't get into that today. That's a whole other matter. I should probably do a little bit of a personal disclaimer at this point about my background. Some people know that I did spend a long time working for the city's development agency, then known as MCDA, Minneapolis Community Development Agency, but I did not work in downtown development. I really worked in the neighborhood programs. My heart was really in the neighborhood work. My first job was as a community organizer in the Powderhorn Park and Central neighborhood. So I'm really closely involved with the neighborhood work, but when I was at MCDA, I was close enough to the downtown development activity to know that it was really the economic engine that funded a lot of important neighborhood work, particularly the neighborhood revitalization program that some of you may know about. So let us start with some of the historic specifics, and I want to go back to October 1956. And this is where I get to be the history professor and ask, does anybody know what happened in October 1956 that had very important significance for downtown development? What happened in 1956? It happened outside of downtown? Southdale, that is right. You get the award here. And I had this wonderful slide here. I think it just shows Southdale. Well, there it is. I'll pass this around. One of the technology problems here. And actually, I'll, Don, if you want to just let people see this. I brought hard copies. I believe in hard copies. I don't trust technology. It's my age, I guess. So, you know, we tend to take Southdale for granted now. It's been around for a long time. It's, you know, sitting out there sort of faded. But in the mid-1950s, Southdale was an incredibly big deal. And I think those of us who were around then can remember that it was the biggest thing to happen to Minnesota, certainly in that era. Southdale has to be seen to be believed, the Minneapolis Tribune gushed. The center is an astonishing combination of modern retailing and the traditional town square in an always summertime atmosphere. And the project's architect, Victor Gruen, described it in even more grandiose terms. He says, "I hope it becomes a crystallizing force for the sprawling suburban area. This is a town square that has been lost since the coming of the automobile. It should become the center of this civilization." A little hyperbole, but I think it gives you some sense of, you know, what people thought about the first fully climate-controlled indoor shopping center in the entire country. It was a very big deal back in the 1950s. And of course, as we remember, it was developed by the Dayton Company, the Dayton Brothers. And the Dayton Company, I still call it Dayton's. I know it's got another name now, but it's still Dayton's over there on Nicollet Avenue. It was the Dayton Company's first suburban store, but we also might forget that it also housed Dayton's chief competitor, Donaldson's, and Donaldson's has sort of faded into the mist. In downtown Minneapolis, Dayton's and Donelson's faced each other across the 7th and Nicollet intersection. And they and other Southdale retailers, Juster, some of us remember that store, still had substantial ties to their downtown real estate. And while these companies could move their stores, they couldn't move their real estate. So obviously, they had sort of a foot in both camps. They wanted to benefit from the suburban surge, but yet they still had, were anchored in this older, congested, somewhat economically obsolete central business district that was downtown Minneapolis. And this was a period when the suburban surge was taking effect. The year before Southdale opened, suburbia had already lured one business out of downtown. General Mills moved out in 1955 out to Golden Valley. And I think Minneapolis leaders, you know, could wonder, as well as urban leaders all across the country, were downtowns really going to die in the face of this suburban surge? So one of the things that happened, I think, that was quite significant is that the downtown merchants and real estate interests organized themselves to form the Downtown Council. And the Downtown Council became an effective lobbying force for downtown, and it still serves that role today. And the Downtown Council early on did something that was quite interesting. They lobbied City Hall to revive the moribund City Planning Department. That happened before. A former mayor is in the room now, but in the 1950s, the early 1950s, the planning department was not very significant. And I think the downtown merchants and real estate interests were disturbed that with the freeways coming, that the Minneapolis planning department couldn't give them any good data on how the freeways were going to work. So they wanted the city planning department revived, and that was an early objective of the downtown council. And so what happened is that they did, the city was able to attract a high-profile city planner, a guy named Larry Irvin. Some of us really old-timers may remember Larry. Tucked out of the corner of his mouth, sort of this garrulous guy, and when he walked into the room, you know, you really knew that Larry was there. And 2 years earlier, 1956, another name that we real old-timers remember, Robert Jorvig was hired to run the Minneapolis Housing and Redevelopment Authority, the HRA. Larry Irvin was at the City Planning Department. Bob Jorvig was at the HRA. And between the two of them, they really helped set the agenda for downtown development, certainly in the 50s into the 60s. And in a later period, Tommy Thompson, city coordinator, filled some of that same role. In 1957, Bob Jorvig was able to secure a federal grant to renew the city's aging gateway area, really the skid row of Minneapolis. And actually, I'm turned around, it's that way, not that way. A very ambitious project. It was at its time the largest downtown urban renewal project in the country. It was going to rebuild a third of the downtown. Now let me see if I can actually, okay, good, we actually can show that. Great work. This shows you the original gateway plan. This is the railroad yards, of course, which are gone. Here's Nicollet Avenue, here's Hennepin Avenue, this is the old Nicollet Hotel. The boundaries were slightly modified, but this gives you a general sense of where the gateway area is. A new library, now there's a newer new library on this corner, but this was the basic project area for Gateway. And Gateway got substantial help from Minnesota's Senator Hubert Humphrey, of course, a former mayor. That was a time when there were a lot of discretionary federal grants, and Minneapolis was very well connected and got the grant, $18 million for what was the largest downtown urban renewal project in the country. Immediately began buying a property all through this area. Probably the most significant property that was purchased was the Metropolitan Building. Ironically, the Metropolitan Building housed the offices of the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. And a real architectural gem built in 1890, Romanesque Revival style. Its time was the largest office building, highest office building between the Chicago and the West Coast. And of course, as we know, the Metropolitan Building was demolished for the Gateway Project. And I think the demolition of the Metropolitan Building, which occurred in 1961, really gave Gateway Urban Renewal its bad name that still lingers today. But there is another side of the story also that hasn't been told, and that is that Jorvig and the HRA staff really made a concerted effort to get the Metropolitan Building restored and renovated. And they went to the owner, tried to work with the owner of the building, offered actually to help fund the renovation of the Metropolitan Building. He refused. He was really interested only in the largest possible condemnation award he could get for the building. This was before adaptive reuse. People could even imagine that was considered an old building. I mean, now we think it's an architectural gem, how you could reuse it. So unfortunately, the Metropolitan Building did come down, but the story is a little bit more complicated, sort of the good guys and the bad guys. I think it was unfortunate that it happened, but it was sort of a factor of its time then. And if Gateway would have come along 10 years later as the historic renovation effort was getting underway, we'd probably still have the Metropolitan Building today. The land out there that we just saw in the map stood sort of vacant for a long time. The Knutson Company was given the development rights to develop the area. It took quite a while for the blocks to fill in. What was built in Gateway was not particularly distinguished. Most of the buildings have come down already, but there are a couple that are still in place. That's one of them, the Towers Apartments, which we can't, I can see the towers, but you can't from here. And I think what's significant about the Tower Apartments, built as a result of the Gateway Project, that it really launched the downtown residential revival boom. This is the first middle-income housing to be built in downtown Minneapolis. The other building, which I still is one of my favorites, what was then called the Northwestern National Life Insurance Building, designed by Minoru Yamasaki. I think that's stood the test of time. I like the way their columns still sort of anchor Nicollet Avenue. And this, of course, is now known as the Ing Tower, once the Dutch company Ing purchased Northwestern National Life Insurance. Let's see how we're doing here. I guess, well, all right, 12 more minutes to go here. I got to talk fast. 15. Gateway was a public effort funded primarily with federal funds, but the next important thing that happened in downtown was really a private effort spearheaded by an energetic private entrepreneur, fellow named Leslie Parks. And Leslie Parks Baker Properties had a large holdings in downtown Minneapolis. And Parks was smart enough to know, with Southdale and the suburban surge coming, that downtown either had to grow or die. So Parks came up with a scheme that many thought was rather harebrained at the time, and that was to connect buildings at the second story level with an enclosed walkway. And when Parks floated his ideas, the downtown merchants said, no, that'll, you know, I don't think that's going to work. If people come on the first floor, they're not going to go up on the second floor. But Parks kept working at this. He, when he developed his own building, the North Star Center, he was able to build his own skyway. And let's see if we, yeah, there we show that. Okay, good, it's working. And this shows the opening of the first skyway in 1962 between the North Star Building and what was then the Northwestern Bank Building, excuse me. And as we know, of course, the skyway system sort of morphed. I have this image of this octopus sort of crawling through downtown. Unfortunately, I don't have the map of the current system, but now the skyway system covers some 80 blocks in downtown Minneapolis, 8 miles of skyway, the largest skyway system in the world. And I know the skyways have sort of been lambasted by the city planners. They say, well, it's sapping the energy of street retail. And what I'd like to do And one of my rants is, take those city planners, make them leave their coats at home, stick them out on Nicollet Avenue and 7th Street on January 30th when it's 30 below, and see how much they like the street ambiance at that point. I know that the Skyway system is confusing, it's hard to find your way around, but I think it's undeniable that it's had a really substantial impact on the development of downtown. Leslie Parks was also indirectly responsible for the next big idea that came along in downtown, another scheme that probably was really harebrained, and that is that Parks wanted to cover over Nicollet Avenue between 5th Street and 9th Street with a covering and make it sort of a downtown Southdale with an enclosed shopping center on Nicollet Avenue. And that idea really never took off, but it did plant the seeds of an idea on the part of the downtown leaders on what should happen to Nicollet Avenue. It's an aging street. The big department stores were all still lined up on Nicollet Avenue. And so the question is what to do with Nicollet Avenue. So in the 1960s, the downtown council hired a planning firm from Evanston, Illinois, Barton Ashman, to look at Nicollet Avenue and figure out how it might be reimagined and reconfigured. And what Barton Ashman discovered is that at that point, many of the downtown shoppers were taking the bus downtown to the downtown department stores, but the buses didn't run on Nicollet Avenue mainly. They were on Hennepin Avenue and Marquette and 2nd. So what Barton Ashman came up with, which was their big great breakthrough, was to establish a transit way on Nicollet Avenue, which would be open only to buses, but not to automobiles. And it would just become a busway. But more than just a busway, they wanted to embellish it with planting, sculptures, made the road curving, make it into a real urban amenity. And of course, that became the Nicollet Mall that we know well. And this slide shows a Nicollet Mall under construction in 1967. In the fall of 1967, the Nicollet Mall opens to rave reviews. Almost immediately, it began to increase sales on the part of the downtown merchants. And of course, starting in 1970, as we know, the Nicollet Mall got national television exposure, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Mary throwing her hat up in front of the IDS building. I think she's still throwing her hat up on 7th next to Dayton's. So the mall was a great success early on. It prompted leaders to almost immediately begin working for an extension. When it opened, it stopped at 10th Street, and the extension moved the mall out to 13th, where it ends now in front of the Hyatt Hotel. And I don't think, oops. All right. We had the mall now by the late 60s. We had the Skyways. This was really putting Minneapolis on the urban development map. And Minneapolis was basking in national acclaim. Planners from all over the world were coming to downtown Minneapolis to see these amazing developments that were sort of reviving an aging central business district in the face of all of this suburban activity. And Minneapolis was really sort of the Portland, Oregon of its time. I think right now the planners look to Portland as they're in the forefront of all the urban development, the latest, newest trends. And I think certainly back in the 60s and the 70s, Minneapolis played that role very specifically. And while all this national acclaim was underway, the planners were busy putting together an important blueprint that I talked about at the beginning of this talk. And in 1970, they unveiled something called Metro Center 85. And this says downtown 15 years ago, but this was published in 1970, so of course 15 years later was 1985. And I think what's really amazing about this sort of hard to read plan, and there in the files of the library there are more details on this, is how much it really predicted what was going to happen in downtown. And none of this was in place. Number one here, this was residential along the riverfront. This was a time when the riverfront was really a wasteland. Nothing doing, but the planners envisioned this as a residential boom. They talked about an eventual population of 50,000 downtown. I don't think we're quite at that level yet, but pretty close. Number six, this was going to be a series of parking ramps at the end of what became 394. And of course, as we know, the parking ramps are there. Number four was going to be a civic center around the courthouse. We have that now with the county and the federal building. Number three was a cultural center, not quite where the Guthrie Theater is, but pretty close. Number five was a community college at Loring Park, which is what we have today. And this really did provide the blueprint, I think, which has stayed in place through all this time and really has guided development. And I think, again, back to the skyways, what the planners have really pushed is to have a compact downtown, which I think has really made a difference. And we have a more compact downtown than other urban centers where it's been very easy to somebody plunk a big shop, a big office tower away from the core of the city. So I think the Metro Center 85 plan was incredibly important and significant for the future of downtown. But it was nonetheless just a plan, just words on paper, as important as it was. And by the 1970s, city leaders were saying, what are we going to do for the next generation of development activity? And by this time, by the mid-1970s, the era of urban renewal had been over. Urban renewal had funded the Gateway development, but urban renewal by the mid-70s was done. It had gotten bad press because of the bulldozing effect, and the federal largesse had dried up, and city leaders realized that they're going to have to come up with their own tools. So a key tool that they made use of, it had been used other places besides downtown, was tax increment financing. I'm not going to go into all of the details of tax increment financing. The basic concept is fairly simple. The city buys up a blighted site, demolishes it, puts in public improvements, sells it off to a private developer, issues bonds to cover those public costs, and then the incremental taxes generated by that parcel go to pay off the bonds. Now, people, tax increment's gotten a bad name. People have said, well, you know, you're taking money out of the general fund that would go to pay for homeless shelters and parks and schools and putting it, giving it to developers. And what happens with tax increment is it's the incremental taxes generated by that parcel that pays off the bonds. The base, the taxes that that parcel was paying before continues to go into the general fund, but it's the increment that pays off the bonds. Well, the critics say, but that development would have happened anyway, so why are you using tax increment? Because if we just let nature take its course and the economy work its way, the development would have happened and then all that money would have gone into the general fund. And that's the basic criticism of tax increment financing. But the question is, would that really have happened? And that's the big question, hard to say. Let me see if I've got one more. Nope, sorry. This was the first big downtown development, not very architecturally distinguished. We can actually see it out the door, yeah, out the window here. We know this site. This was a site that had, before City Center came along, had more than 25 individually owned parcels. There's no way, given that split in the parcels, that that could have developed on its own. And so the city did acquire that site through eminent domain, also a controversial tool, use tax increment to develop it, and it's given us City Center, which is still there today, not very distinguished, but still an economic anchor for downtown. I'm getting sort of to the end here to race through a lot of stuff, and the book has more, doesn't have as many pictures, and I'm really sorry that I don't have all my wonderful slides that I worked on for a week. But anyway, what I want to end up with, just real quickly, because we're getting pretty close to the end, is the story of the downtown theaters. I think that the historic theaters have played an incredibly important role in downtown. Let me see if we've got... the first theater to be renovated, the state was a big battle, was a historic preservation battle. The developer that was going to develop this block, and can we see it out here? I'm all turned around here. the original plan was to demolish the state theater. It had been sort of an aging, faded movie palace. But the historic preservationists by now, in the 1970s, had really organized, and I think with the help of City Council President Sharon Sales Belton at that period, who I don't think has gotten the credit she deserves on some of this work, was able to keep the state to preserve it and renovate it. And there, the project around the State Theater, LaSalle Plaza, which I think I showed you at the beginning, generated the tax increment to renovate the state. The next theater, the Orpheum, let me see if we show that here. Oops, no, ahead of ourselves here. The next one was the Orpheum. Another little little quiz here, little interesting fact. Does anybody know who owned the Orpheum Theater at the time that the city purchased it? This is one of those things they ask in Almanac. Bob Dylan, that's right. Bob Dylan owned the Orpheum Theater. Didn't pay much attention to it. He was busy with other stuff. You get both awards there today. The place was a mess. Talk about sewage seeping through the walls, and the touring companies thought, "Oh, this is Orpheum. We don't want to go there anymore." But it still, you know, underneath its shabby facade, had a lot of architectural quality, and the state had been successful, so that got the MCDA then to move on to the Orpheum. There was no tax increment at the Orpheum, but the device that was used to fund that renovation was a surtax on the theater tickets. And so the city issued bonds to pay for the renovation of the Orpheum, and then I don't know how it might still be in place. I think it is. Every time you bought a ticket to go to the Orpheum, there was a surtax that then went to pay off the bonds. The next theater, which we don't have a slide for, was originally known as the RKO Pan, now the Pantages. That's renovated, and I think it's significant to start with the last theater here, the Schubert Theater. We see this being pulled down Hennepin Avenue to its new site on 5th and Hennepin. And of course, as we maybe know, that next week, a ground will be broken for what will become the Minnesota Schubert Center. And this will be developed by the nonprofit Art Space connected to the Hennepin Center for the Arts. So this sort of brings us up to date to actually a current theater development, and I think I have just barely made my 30 minutes here. So I guess what I'd like to do at this point is throw it open to comments, questions. Some of you were involved in some of this history, and would like to hear from you. So, questions? Yes, Tom.
Eric, what do you think of Block E?
Block E has not been terribly successful, and I think that I talk a little bit about that in the epilogue of the book. I tended to talk today about the successes. Could Block E have been done differently? I don't know. The city was very engaged in sort of an entertainment center, and that was a big thing. I mean, in the 70s, we had festive retailing, and then in the 90s, we had, you know, downtown entertainment center. And I think it's probably not worked very well. I think there is some hope that with the ballpark, which we can see out here just a few blocks away, that maybe that might help revive Block E. Block E, for just if you don't know, that got its designation from the map that had an E for that block, and it was a real tawdry sort of crime center before it was redeveloped. And people sort of romanticized that block because it had a lot of urban grit. But at the point that... And former mayor may know about that project. So there was a big effort to renovate it. Actually, it's interesting. There was a plan to put the Guthrie Theater there, and which would have been an interesting development. But the Guthrie board said, "Oh no, we don't want to be downtown." That's, yeah, it's, but maybe the Guthrie should have been downtown. That would have been an interesting development, actually, an entertainment center. So, yes. Mm-hmm.
How do you see the relationship between neighborhood organizing and development and downtown development coming out of the South Side? Evidently, you're involved with some of that. I was. There was this kind of sometimes pose that there was at least a competition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a big issue. Yeah, well, I mean, the reality is that downtown development generated the tax increment surplus that funded a $20 million neighborhood revitalization program, which put a lot of money into community organizing. And I think being a community organizer, that's probably the most important thing that's happened. So I think, in fact, downtown has paid the bills for a lot of neighborhood development work. Now, the revenue stream that's funded NRP is drying up now, and there has to be some new money put in, but I always thought that this dichotomy, the neighborhoods were being ignored and all the entrance intention to downtown, I think was sort of a false dichotomy. So.
You mentioned that the Metropolitan Building was really an architectural gem and yet it was torn down. And now we look upon a lot of the buildings that replaced the old ones as eyesores, bad architecture. But the National Trust is saying, oh no, you need to save the modern architecture, examples of an era. We did tear down the library, probably some other buildings. Are there some that are likely to be torn down that you think, oh no, those should be preserved?
Well, you know, the one that I really feel badly about that was torn down was the Lutheran Brotherhood building. That was really a nice building. That was an international, you know, international style, the glass and steel building. I think that was really a high quality building. I don't think that the middle library was very high quality. I mean, the one international building we have of that era, and I think we can see it out the window here, I think is the First National Bank building. Can we see it here? I'm so turned around. Where's the old First Bank building? Where is it? Oh, down below. Okay. You know, I'm looking at right at the very top. That, I think, is one example of that international, the Mies van der Rohe international style. It's probably worth preserving downtown. I don't know of any other building from that 19, you know, early modern period that's got any great architectural integrity. Others might disappear.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the downtown stadiums? I mean, as a concept.
Well, I don't know if we want to get into that topic. I've had my friends here. I am not, I have to tell you personally, I am not a sports fan. I am sort of the anti-sports fan. I personally am offended that I have to spend 1.5 cents or half of 1.5 cents every time I buy something or whatever it is, or 1/10 of 1 cent or whatever it is. To pay for the stadium. I have nothing wrong with stadiums, but I just don't think, given all the other uses, that is a wise public expenditure. And I don't really believe that it's going to have a substantial development impact. I mean, we take the Metrodome, great building. Metrodome really has not generated substantial development there. I think what's going to happen with the stadium isn't so much the stadium, but that's where the LRT and the North Star commuter line is going to come together. So I think that'll have more impact at the stadium itself. But we've got it there, sort of wedged into that really tight site. I guess it'll have some amenities around it, but remains to be seen whether that's really going to generate in its of itself development.
The Target Center.
Well, I think the Target Center has been a huge drain on the city. I mean, it's a bottomless pit because I can't remember the ownership structure. The Target Center was originally built. Wilson, the two guys built it. Then I think the city bought it, or still has got some kind of ownership interest or is committed to cover it. So I think with the Excel Center opening in St. Paul, that's taken a lot of the high buck sports and entertainment venues away from it. So I don't know that the Target Center has really, it's gotten some restaurants and bars going around there, but the city is on the hook for a huge expenditure to cover those operating and renovation costs for that property. So, yes?
With the benefit of hindsight, imagine you're back in 1985. What would you say about that plan? I guess it was actually in 1970. The
1970 plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go way back. What if you were the permanent mayor? What changes would you want to make to the plan played out?
Well, you know, I think it was really interesting. I think that the downtown, the residential downtown was really important. I can't think of anything that would necessarily be changed. I think that the idea of those parking ramps at the end of 394, I know, you know, we don't want cars and we need transit, which we're going to get. But I think that was a useful connection, whether the skyways could have been done a little bit more efficiently and less confusing to funnel people into downtown. But I think, you know, that plan has really met the test of time, and I think has really made a big difference. And I think folks are really far-sighted. We forget, you know, what downtown looked like in 1970. So I can't think of, at this point, anything that I would necessarily change in that particular plan. Yes?
Eric, I think the really important thing about the downtown plan was the decision to have a very tight central core. And that enabled then the skyway system to be built. Mm-hmm. If we hadn't done that, then buildings would have been scattered all over and the skyway system probably would never have taken off, which to me has always underscored the importance of a strong planning department, something that hasn't necessarily prevailed over the years. So.
Yes, Tom?
Why did Minneapolis fall behind and get supplanted by Portland? Is it mainly mass transit? And why are we so deficient on mass transit?
Well,
why are we
the only metropolitan area that doesn't
have a subway system?
Yeah, I don't see any current elected officials in the room. I don't think so. I think what happened, and I believe this in all honesty, that you had staff, I guess you'd call it that, really having a strong vision, setting the agenda. I think now the elected officials much more tightly manage development than they did before, so you don't have a Bob Jorvik or a Larry Irvin who can sort of have the big picture and have the political wherewithal to sort of move those plans through. I think things are fragmented. Obviously, there's more competition for dollars. There are a lot of different players now. Somebody joked that when the current mayor has to make a decision, he has to consult with everybody, including his aromatherapist. And maybe in an earlier era, we didn't have to have quite as engagement that we have now. And engagement has become a mantra for us, which is important. We all agree with engagement, but we got so much engagement. We're engaging with everybody, and sometimes it's really, really hard to make any decisions. I think mass transit, that's a really good thing. I mean, lots of battles. My last chapter of the book is all the Hiawatha LRT battle. I mean, that was hung in the balance, and I think and some of the people that really deserve the credit for making that happen also haven't gotten the credit that they deserve, someone like Carol Flynn. And we came very close to losing the Hiawatha LRT. If Hiawatha LRT hadn't happened, I think none of the other transit developments would have happened. And the other thing that happened, interestingly enough, is that we had a governor named Jesse Ventura who was a strong supporter of Hiawatha LRT. And I think if Jesse hadn't been there, we had a current governor in place then, we wouldn't have had Hiawatha. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that this area is known for back in the day as being a leader of, and then switched over to Portland, was regional mm-hmm. planning and regional governance. Was there any relationship between what you're outlining here and the strong regional?
Well, you know, I think there was an effort to move the Metropolitan Council beyond its current configuration and maybe make it an elected body. I think what's happened is, I mean, certainly the Met Council is taking the lead now on transit, which is important, but it's hard to move to that next phase. I think some of the things that Portland has done with their development controls on a regional basis would be politically almost impossible to happen here, and I'm not quite sure what the political dynamics are in Portland to really have such strong development controls, but I think that's probably what distinguishes the Portland region from what we've got. So I think Met Council has played an important role in transit, but they haven't really contained metropolitan sprawl, which is probably the biggest metropolitan problem. So, just a little aside about a little story about Jesse and the LRT in vintage Jesse style. I've got this in the book. He was doing something with Ted Turner. He was flying off for all this entertainment gigs or something. And so he was going down to Atlanta to do something with Ted Turner and one of his movie channels, and so he's at the airport, and he was about to take a cab downtown to Ted Turner's office, and so somebody in the plane said, no, they've got this transit thing. He says, you know, if you get on at the airport, it'll take you right downtown and drop you off right in front of Ted Turner's building. So Jesse gets on the train, and sure enough, gets deposited right in front of Ted Turner's building, and he comes back. He says, you know, that was great. He says, you know, the money I saved on cab fare, I could run my jet skis all weekend on that money that I saved on the... So for Jesse, everything was personal, but, you know, fine. So,
Ron? I've gotten there because I've read your book, but how long was the Hiawatha line in kind of controversy?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, and in my my chapter on it, I show this map. The very first page is this hand-drawn map in 1974 that showed by a guy named Ken Fletcher, who was sort of almost an amateur transit guy. 1974 has a map showing the alignment of the Hiawatha LRT almost exactly as it is today, even with retail out on the Mall of America site, which of course was far away. So the groups that were pushing for, that were involved in that, were involved in the fight over Highway 55, and a current former congressman got caught up in that Highway 55 battle, and he was besieged by angry constituents because they felt that he was supporting highways over transit. And so that battle over Highway 55 went on in the 70s and 80s. The neighborhood folks who were on the board then were pushing for a light rail transit companion to Highway 55. But light rail transit was very controversial then in the 70s. The Citizens League strongly lobbied against light rail transit. The newspapers were against light rail transit. The DFL majority in the city council was against light rail transit because the labor unions saw this as a way of deflecting highways. They wanted highways. So light rail was very, very controversial through the 70s and 80s. Then what happened is, starting in the early 90s, that got sidetracked. There was going to be an idea for light rail transit down 35W, and that never took off. And then finally, in the late 90s, mid-90s, the sort of the Hiawatha corridor was rediscovered with this compromise on Highway 55. Peter McLaughlin was very instrumental in this. Peter and others said, look, we've got two important people in Congress. We've got Martin Sable, who's on the Appropriations Committee. We've got Jim Oberstar on the Public Works Committee. Let's maximize our political leverage to get Hiawatha LRT going. But there was a big fight over the match, and that's so it took a long time. And, you know, I think timing was great. If Carol hadn't been there in the Senate, if Jesse hadn't been governor at that time, none of this would have happened.
I hardly asked the question because I think we're rushing the Central Corridor too much.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, you read in the paper today, and there was an article about that. You know, if Peter Bell is saying that if they don't resolve the controversy with the university, that could be dead. Now, I don't know if that's the case or not. That's what the Met Council is saying. So,
maybe as the only St. Paul representative in the room, and I'm not from here originally. I grew up in Detroit, so it's all a mystery to me. What happened to St. Paul while all this stuff was happening in Minneapolis?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a whole other thing, and I actually I'm going to give another talk, as Arvon knows, and my talk in December is going to be why is Minneapolis so different from St. Paul. So, come to that. St. Paul's got such a different environment. I mean, certainly there have been activity. There have been some downtown renewal in St. Paul. But St. Paul is much more relaxed than Minneapolis is. They're much more, as I say in the book, sort of comfortable in their own skin. They don't need to keep reinventing themselves. And, you know, they don't want to be a New York. They don't want to be really big league. They're content to be, you know, middle league. And that's very comfortable. And I was thinking, you know, that's sort of good. Minneapolis is always, you know, we got to keep changing. We got to be hip. We got to be modern. And, you know, we got to have the latest this and the latest that. And, we can't. Yeah, and St. Paul is a little bit more relaxed. I mean, I go into some of this in the book, a very different history as former mayor here, Wells knows, huge fights over the charter in Minneapolis, as we just know earlier this month with the weird battle over the Board of Estimate and Taxation. St. Paul doesn't have any of that stuff. Their structure is much simpler. They've got a much longer history of better ethnic and race relations than we do here. So it's a more relaxed, as I say, they're more comfortable in their own skin. They don't need to keep reinventing themselves, but they're really doing pretty well. So, yes?
Caravan is worried that we're building the Central Corridor too quickly, and I'm worried that we're way behind all of these other cities as far as public transit is concerned. I think something like 24 of the other 25 largest metropolitan areas have public transit systems that are ahead of us. You've talked about, this organization was against it, that organization was against it. Were our groups not attending conferences? Were they not aware of what was happening in the rest of the nation?
Well, it is interesting. One, what is interesting is places that are, you would think are pretty conservative, like Phoenix, Arizona, and Houston, Texas, have got regional funding systems in place to support their transit. Now, we do have this new sales tax surcharge that can be used for transit. I think some of the counties have opted out of it. But we've had a hard time pulling together. I think a little bit of it is a Minneapolis-St. Paul issue because during the late 90s, when Norm Coleman was mayor of St. Paul, St. Paul came pretty close to sort of trying to sandbag the Hiawatha LRT, saying, why are they doing it over there? They finally worked it out politically. So I think the nature of our region with sort of the two center cities has sort of impeded that. And I think we've just had a hard time coming up with a regional sort of consensus. And other communities really have gone beyond us, whether we're so locked into our localism. But it's been really tough. And we really don't have a viable funding source. And that's why each time these projects come in place, and certainly with Hiawatha LRT, it was a big fight to get money out of the legislature because there wasn't an ongoing ongoing revenue source. So, in some ways, I think we're ahead of other places, but in other ways, we're not. Looks like we're sort of getting talked out here. So, well, thank you very much. This is a great, great discussion.
This podcast of the Downtown Discussion Group was recorded on November 12, 2009, at Fredrickson and Byron Law Firm. This podcast is a project of the DFL Education Foundation, with production services provided by iDream.tv.